You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It may be hard to believe, but just 40 years ago, the term environmentalist did not even exist. People who worried about pollution and saving the planet were called conservationists and definitely not considered mainstream, and their issues were just beginning to be discussed. As a founder, executive director, later president of one of the most effective environmental organizations, Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC, John Hamilton Adams has been at the forefront of this fight since 1970. In a book called A Force for Nature, The Story of NRDC and the Fight to Save a Planet, written by Mr. Adams with his wife Patricia Adams and George Black, they tell the story of how it all began and of some of their greatest triumphs and some of the real difficulties they faced. It's published by Chronicle Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings John and Patricia Adams to our show today. Hello.
It's nice to be here.
Thank you very much for having us.
The foreword of your book was written by Robert Redford, who was the celebrity face of environmental causes for a number of years. Several emerging environmental groups competed for his endorsement in the 1970s. How did you win him over to your organization so early on in 1974?
Well, the first thing that we did was go to New Mexico on when there was the issues of big coal development power plants out at the Four Corners, and he was very interested in that. And we met with him.
It is shocking when you drive down those roads in that gorgeous scenery, and then there are these power plants just dropping an awful lot of black smoke into the sky.
Yeah, it's a real problem. I mean, there's nothing about coal that's clean, and, you know, we have to figure out a way to get ourselves away from coal. That's part of what NRDC has been working on for a long time.
So he signed on because of that issue.
Well, we met him then, and his wife was at that time, Lola, was very interested in clean air, and he gave us a movie benefit, and it was All the President's Men. And so with Lola's organization and NRDC, it was our first benefit in 1975, I believe. And thereafter, because of our effectiveness with litigation, he really felt very, very strong that we were an organization that he could back.
That's one of the things Redford has said, that NRDC could litigate, and that was very important.
Your book begins some years before at a crossroads in your life, John. You'd been serving under Robert Morgenthau in the U.S. Attorney's Office, working on a joint strike force in the Organized Crime and Racketeering Division. Doesn't sound like anything that would get somebody into environmental law.
No, that's true. It was very different. And I must say, working with Bob Morgenthau for 5 years really made my career. He's a wonderful guy, and it was a very collegial place. People were very, very bright. And I was able to take that model and try to incorporate it into the building of NRDC.
What about your earlier experience in corporate law, which you say repeatedly you knew was not the kind of law that you wanted to practice? Still, it must have prepared you for dealing with all the lawyers of the corporations you had to go up against.
You know, it's very true. And we made numbers of friends from my old law firm, and they still are friends and supporters, none better. But I would have gotten sick to my stomach if I had to return to that practice of law.
On one particular day, you write of sitting, looking at the raw sewage floating down the Hudson River. Why was there so much raw sewage on the Hudson River in 1969? We don't have that anymore, do we?
No, we don't. We like to say that New York is a great story of progress that's been made over the past 40 years. And coming down here to the radio station, we went by our old apartment on in the village that we write about in the book. And it is true. John would see raw sewage in the river. And as we say in the book, if we left a window open in our village apartment, one of our young children would have soot on their forehead in the morning. So the air was truly dirty and the water was dirty. But
it was Dickensian as recently as the late 60s.
That's right. That's right. It just was like thinking of the industrial power plants in England. It was that dirty. And I can remember saying to John, it's one thing for us to breathe this air, but look at our little babies. What are we going to do about this? And there was, of course, at that time, a growing movement throughout the United States about this issue.
Well, 1969 was a big year for environmental activism. There was that oil rig incident off Santa Barbara, California.
Yes, that's just one of the many things that happened in the late 60s and the mid-60s that got us headed in the right direction. Rachel Carson, Mineral King out in California was being developed, and the Sierra Club was opposed to it. And in New York, Storm King. And the Storm King fight really helped get us off the ground. The people who fought Storm King, a wonderful group of lawyers, very prominent people in the community, and they came to me and basically said, look, we spent a lot of money fighting Storm King, and we want to make some use out of it, something good that will last on. And we'd like to start an NAACP for the Legal Defense Fund for the Environment. And that's really how we got started.
And what was the Storm King issue over?
The building of a pump storage plant on the very beautiful face of Storm King. And so Con Edison was seeking peak power. And the people who opposed it were artists, people from the New York Times, the principal critic of the New York Times, and many, many others joined in the fight. And that became the case that allowed citizens to bring lawsuits based on standing of beauty and recreation.
And Whitney North Seymour was part of that founding group, and he had worked with John at the U.S. Attorney's Office. And what this group of lawyers, fairly well funded, realized that normal citizens, ordinary people, were going to have a very hard time coming up against a big corporation in these issues, and knew there should be a public interest law firm for the environment.
And the NAACP model was what you were basing this on?
Pretty much. And, you know, it got modified along the way. Thurgood Marshall and the Civil Liberties Union. I mean, it was an amalgam of those. And really also I had been visiting with the Center for Law and Social Policy in Washington, and that was a great model as well.
I was wondering about that oil spill in the Pacific. It took only 11 days to stop the spill as opposed to the 3 months and 4.4 million gallons of oil that were spilled in the Gulf of Mexico from the Deepwater Horizon accident. Did we know more about stopping spills in those days, or was it closer to shore? Was that why it was easier to take?
It was closer to shore, and it was more manageable. And even so, you know, it really stopped additional drilling out in the Pacific. And then all of a sudden, now we are 20 years later, and we're drilling 25,000 feet into the ground. At the ends of the earth, I like to say, without having any backup programs, without having really anybody monitoring what's taking place, it's scandalous.
My guests are John H. Adams and Patricia Adams, who, with the help of George Black, who is the editor of the NRDC's quarterly magazine called On Earth. On Earth. I knew I'd get to it. Have published a book called A Force for Nature. It's published by Chronicle. Well, President Nixon took it very seriously. He said the Santa Barbara incident has frankly touched the conscience of the American people and led to the first Earth Day celebration and the birth of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the Clean Air Act of 1970.
Yes, that's true.
Moving backward?
Well, we're not moving backward. I think, in fact, if you take a look at the Clean Air Act and the Clean Air Act amendments and the impact that the Clean Air Act has had on this country's air and soon to have an impact on carbon, the Supreme Court has determined that carbon is a pollutant. It now comes under the Clean Air Act. And while we haven't been able to pass a climate bill, we do have the Clean Air Act and Lisa Jackson. So if the history of the Clean Air Act is followed the way it should be, we are very lucky that 40 years later we have the Clean Air Act.
And I just quickly like to go back to your question about Santa Barbara. John likes to use the phrase, and I like the phrase, going to the extremes to get fossil fuels. Now, that's what's happening. The easy stuff has been gotten. So now, whether it's drilling in the Gulf or tar sands up in Canada or mountaintop removal, we are really invading the earth in a much greater way than we did 40 years ago.
And President Nixon signed that legislation, but you said before we went on the air that he also gave you a hard time as in the early days of the NRDC?
Yes, he did sign that legislation, and he signed a lot of other legislation during the early years of his administration. Indeed, there were thousands of bills introduced. Not all thousands were enacted, but a lot of legislation, so it was a great time. But at the same time, he didn't like troublemakers. And one of the things he did was instruct his staff to work on eliminating these lawyers who are interfering with the agencies. And so they denied us our tax-exempt status if we chose to litigate. And that almost put us out of business because funders really couldn't give us money unless we could litigate. We had been licensed to practice law the first time in the country as a charitable corporation, but we were not going to be able to litigate. So we had a huge fight, and that fight, ultimately, we won.
Patricia, were issues like global warming, creating renewable energy, establishing nationwide recycling programs, limiting one's carbon footprint, were they being discussed at the time?
Well, those phrases weren't used. Are you talking about back in the 70s, yeah, in the early times? Certainly recycling was already an issue. And George Woodwell, who was one of the early board members, was already talking about the potential carbon imbalance. But I must admit, that was pretty far away. The issues were somewhat basic, although they stay the same today. It was, can we get our air clean, our water clean? And the fact that citizens have the right to this was a sort of a new idea. In the 50s, you sort of thought you had to bow to progress. You know, everything, you know, can't get in that way. But those issues, there was a great deal of awareness, consciousness raising in a way about these issues in the 70s.
Are we still talking about bowing to progress? An awful lot of the fight always seems to be over whether we are going to be hurting industry, losing jobs, if we practice good things for the environment.
Well, there's no question. That's the issue. And you see it in the Congress, and you see it in the elections, and you see the great expenditure of lobby money by oil, gas, coal, and railroads because they want a competitive advantage here and they want to maintain a carbon future.
And we seem to be getting mixed message from the voters. The voters of California voted in favor of the environment on one of the propositions that
they
voted on.
They have continued to do so. I'd like to just
mention, a lot of the people who won election have said that they don't even believe there's such a thing as global warming.
Well, you know, again, I tell you that people forget and they have to be retaught. We need to spend a lot of time with the new legislators. And we've been able to do this in the past. We did it with the 104th Congress and Newt Gingrich. They were going to rewrite all the environmental laws. And when we were faced with that, we were able to bring a force across America to convince Newt Gingrich's of that day that there's a better way to go. And I believe that you'll find that if they attack the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, or go after Lisa Jackson, the same reaction will happen throughout the country, and we'll be able to prevail in protecting the Clean Air Act and Lisa Jackson's ability to control carbon as a pollutant.
And you mentioned the voters. There's no doubt that the economy is a big issue. But what we need to learn and to see is that oil and gas and coal are very expensive without the subsidies and without the bringing in the cost of cleanup. It's an expensive thing, and there are alternatives.
And in your epilogue, you argue that the dialogue on serving the planet must change and be more positive and offer alternatives so people don't worry about losing their jobs.
Well, that's true, and, you know, it's really clear that with the stimulus package, $90 billion is being spent by the Department of Energy. It's really created an investment home for all of the new technology that we need on efficiency and wind and solar, and really in getting people to look at the right kinds of batteries, the right kinds of cars. Changing the way we use our energy is what we're heading for.
We were just in California, and there's a group there, the Environmental Entrepreneurs, that really show how technology is growing in alternative fuels, which is quite exciting.
Although in other parts of the West, there are people who argue that the environmental protection agencies care more for animals and for some plants than they do for people.
Well, there's always people who are complaining about what the government is doing. I would just say that the progress is really on its way now, and you're seeing the high-tech people really leading the way. This group of environmental entrepreneurs, they're amazing people. These are the people that are really making the breakthroughs in broadband and looking at new ways to get mirrors, solar, and we're watching new companies getting started and the building of the solar and the windmills and new technology by Google. They're now thinking about helping to build the new lines out to
the transmission lines
out to the windmills. And so we're halfway there, and we're watching it flip over.
We'll talk about the windmills and other things when we come back. My guests are John H. Adams, who was NRDC's executive director, later president from 1970 to 2006. And he also has served on President Clinton's Council for Sustainable Development. Patricia Adams, a writer, author of three books and numerous articles. They have collaborated on a new book called A Force for Nature with the help of George Black, the author of six books, and he's the articles editor of On Earth, the NRDC's quarterly magazine. A Force for Nature is published by Chronicle. We will continue after this. We're back with John H. Adams and Patricia Adams, who, with the help of George Black, have written a book called A Force for Nature. It's published by Chronicle Books. You mentioned windmills, and I just have to address that for a moment because we just did a show about windmills in upstate New York and the problems that they're causing for people's lives. I don't know whether you think windmills on farms are a good idea or whether we should just build them in desert areas or offshore, but they have really been a problem for an awful lot of people. And the only reason they've been – these 500-foot towers have been able to be erected, they're very inefficient, is because they get so many tax breaks. It's almost in the interest of the electric companies to build them economically.
Well, we're faced with some choices, and the question is, do we want a carbon future or do we want to look for renewable energy? And you know, personally, my choice would be solar, wind. I think we can do better with the technology on wind. I think it can be useful on farms. There are a lot of places in this country that are looking for windmills as a part of their economy. There are remote areas of the United States. The whole idea of building better transmission lines is all part of the future of windmills. And there's also offshore. And sometimes that's troublesome for people from a scenic point of view. But I think we're stuck with the fact that we have to get renewable energy.
Could I make just a general comment about that? There's a theme in the book, which is start small, think big. But in terms of alternative energy, I think we're starting big but thinking smaller. With all technology that succeeds, things get smaller. I mean, now you hold a telephone in your hand and you can talk to China. And I think that with continued research and effort, technology will bring these alternative systems more into line.
The lawyers you put together initially were all from Yale, it seems, and anti-establishment. I don't know if there's some kind of a link there. And some of your first funding came from the Ford Foundation. Were there lawyers on your team who felt that that was the wrong organization to fund an environmental group?
Well, first of all, the group from Yale, this is how I met them. I went to Ford Foundation when we got started and asked them for funding, and they said, you know, there was a group in here in 1969, and now they're all clerking down on the Supreme Court. That was the quality of the folks that we picked up from Yale. Gus Speth, who's been the head of the United Nations Development Program and so on and so forth, and John Bryson, who became the head of Southern California Edison International. And when we got the staff, we were able to deal with the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. We set the country up with rules and regulations, and we were able to build the future of NRDC on qualified, unbelievably talented people. It set a model, and it worked.
One of the first and most trying cases the NRDC undertook was against the IRS. What was at stake there?
What was at stake was whether we would have an organization. They were going to kill us off and denied us our tax exemption. And we began our first major lobbying campaign. We went out with got senators and presidents of universities and a lot of other people who supported us in letting the IRS and the Nixon administration know that we weren't going to take it lying down.
Because he saw you as a great liberal threat, even though he was signing all this legislation.
Right.
The big issue during the Bush years was not whether there was legislation, but whether anyone would enforce it. Is that part of the problem that you've been facing?
We often say that the Environmental Protection Agency is as strong as the administration. And so when you have, you know, the administration not really supporting what is in fact a law, there is a problem there. I think John can speak to that directly.
We clearly, with the Bush administration, we were not getting any help. We had the Cheney energy plan, the secret meetings, and NRDC then quickly moved to work with the states. We were able to get help get California to pass a climate bill, a CARB bill. In New York, which is really our home, we were able to get a whole series of laws that strengthened the climate laws. And you know, it's been a major breakthroughs here in New York and California that let us match the Bush administration's failure.
Whenever these topics are discussed, people say we have to go back to using nuclear power as a way of generating energy. In 1979, there was the meltdown at Three Mile Island, and that pretty much convinced most Americans that it's not a good idea. Where do you stand on that now?
Well, you know, the thing about nuclear power is that we believe it's very expensive. And I think that if they can make nuclear power work at a cost that's the equivalent of efficiency and renewable energy, then we should have that discussion. But I don't see a lot of companies rushing to build nuclear power plants because of the cost.
Our one listener wants to know whether you believe in there can be such a thing as clean coal, which is something that Barack Obama campaigned on during the last election.
I don't believe there is such a thing as clean coal, but I believe that if we need coal, that we can make it carbon, we can make it carbon neutral. Now, that is a new technology that the Department of Energy is funding. Hasn't been proven on a large scale, but and it's very likely that there will continue to be research. And, you know, coal is 50% of our energy right now. It's not easy to get rid of coal. So we want to find out what can we do to clean it up as much as we can and to capture the carbon.
The NRDC gave a favorable review to Ken Salazar when he was nominated by President Obama. Do you still have a favorable view of him?
Well, I think the verdict is out.
Uh-huh. Because there are some positive. Well, how much can a president do if Congress, for example, refuses to pass any climate protection legislation?
Well, it seems to me that we had two legislators, the Senate and the House, Democratic. We passed a climate bill in the House. And we wound up with more than 50 senators who supported a climate bill in the Senate. And we had a president who promised us he was going to be moving a climate bill. It didn't get moved. We now are going to be in quite a different situation. We're not going to have a House ready to pass another climate bill. So now we're going to have to rely again on California, New York, which is Maine to Maryland. California is Oregon, Washington, and New Mexico, and other states that our team is working with out there on climate legislation. And we're going to have to rely on Lisa Jackson and the EPA to enforce the climate laws.
And the administration does support Lisa, so that's a plus, a positive.
A caller is concerned that people in the environmental movement forget that being green is more expensive in every way, carbon-friendly cars, the new light bulbs, organic food. Shouldn't more be done to make this a less elitist move?
Well, I think two things. First of all, it's not necessarily – maybe more expensive up front, but the real cost hasn't been shown. And I think, again, technology is moving that all of these green efforts are going to get cheaper and more efficient.
Yeah, no, you know, New York is a great example. We need a food shed up in the Catskills and into Connecticut and Long Island that is providing organic food that is close to to New York City. And there's a lot of effort going into that. We have a great water supply that we want to protect because that's cheap water, good water, perfect water. And I think on all of these issues, we can become more efficient and really save a lot of money.
Germany subsidizes its solar energy research and its solar energy industry. China seems to be right now the leading country in dealing with environmental, new plans. So why has the United States fallen so far behind?
Well, the question is, are we far behind or are we now really beginning to catch up? I think the stimulus bill is going to make a huge difference. And I think that the technologists, the people from Silicon Valley and Boston and New York and Texas that are working on these issues are going to be driving the technology our way. They are driving it our way now, and I think you're just beginning to really feel what their skills will give us.
My guests have been John H. Adams and Patricia Adams, who, with George Black, have written a book called A Force for Nature. It is the story of the NRDC and the fight to save our planet, published by Chronicle Books. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. Well, it's been nice to be here.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.